right. Where have we been and where we're going? Well, we've been wrestling with what is biblical justice. We've been wrestling with what is the entry point of biblical justice. And on some level, we were even basically answering that by saying the entry point must be Jesus. Why? He exegetes the Father. He is the divine revelation of both what God or who God is, as well as who true humanity is. And so with that entry point in place, understanding that if we're going to exegete both the Old Testament, God Himself, and ourselves, that Jesus must be where we begin. Not our works, but His works. And so that's what we began our awesome little chart with. We started with Jesus' works, which we separated into deeds, which is where we're still at, and words. Deeds and words. This will lead and reveal what? Jesus' identity. All of which is solidified with Jesus' accomplishments, which we separate into three sections. And ascension, exactly. That then ultimately will define our identity. And our identity will then naturally lead to our works, because the more you tell someone who they are, the less you have to tell them what to do, reminding them of their identity. So we began asking the questions, what were the deeds of Jesus? And this was last week when we were doing this, last Thursday actually. What were some of the things that we came up with then? I think we only listed like two or three things on the board, but let's list a couple more. And then I've got a list of my own. Yes? He washes the disciples' feet. That's one of the things that we've brought up last week. Which we found out that the NIV 2011 jacks that up in that chapter 13, verse 1 of John's Gospel, which didn't surprise me a bunch because I'm not too pleased with their new translation. Because it is the fullest extent of God's love is shown in the washing of the feet. What else did Jesus do? What else did He do? Say it again. He forgives the adulterous woman. The woman caught in adultery, which more than likely, we don't need to get into all the details of that. But Jesus knew what was happening. He knew this was fabricated. He knew ultimately that what was happening was the same thing they were trying to do to Him. Well, it was ironic that they probably set a trap to catch her in so that then they could use her as a trap to catch Jesus in. And what does He do? He diffuses the whole situation with love. By actually just putting up a mirror and saying, look in the mirror yourself. That's pretty much what He does. That's a really healthy tactic whenever it comes to dealing with people that are hell-bent on destroying other people. Figure out ways that they have to look in the mirror. It's a pretty powerful way of doing it. And one of the ways of doing that is just love. Other things that Jesus did. What did He do? He healed the paralytic. Pretty important moment. We'll actually talk about how the healing of the paralytic is an incredible link between the works of Jesus and the identity of Jesus. In Mark chapter 2. We'll get to that later. But He does. He heals the paralytic. Even just that broad category is important on some level. Jesus is a healer. Right? I mean, if one of the things, if you're going to talk broad categories of what Jesus was or what He did, you would have to put healing on the list at some point. I mean, even the Jewish people or the Jewish writings that are deriding Jesus, that are attacking Him, one of the things they call Him is a healer, a magician on some level. Even His enemies would bring this up when they're talking about what He did. And they do. What else did Jesus do? Cheat. Open your Bibles. And hopefully at this point, you're 200 level, we're a Jesus school, right? This should be easy. Yes?
He taught in the temple a lot and debated the people of the time that he talked about and kind of used their own things against.
Absolutely. He taught and debated. As a matter of fact, they're usually over issues, especially the debated part, over issues that affect justice-related things. So, or whenever we're talking about the teaching of Matthew 23, my word, He is berating the Pharisees. And he gets to the climactic point of why he's berating them. Because, oh, you tithe when it comes down to even the smallest spices. Down to the smallest ones. And yet, when it comes to the more important things of the law, like justice, mercy, and faithfulness, you ignore them. You disregard them. You don't even address them. What did Jesus do? Yeah. If you're going to be saying at least one thing, you could say Jesus hung out with outcasts. A lot of times it's centered around meals. Matter of fact, an interesting study is just meals in the Gospel of Luke. Jesus is eating with the outcasts. And then on some level you understand why this is so significant. The basic example would be, do you remember the cafeteria in junior high and high school at all? On any level. I mean, granted, it is just a time in which you're eating food, but you know by junior high and high school, it becomes a status game. It becomes a collision of ultimately who you are or who the community views you to be. And if you sat down at the wrong table, if you sat down at a table in which the people that usually sit there don't believe that you have a right to sit there, you may be laughed out of that seat. Why? Because who you eat with, on some level, says something about who you are or who you value. And Jesus is found eating with sinners and tax collectors, which baffled the minds of the Pharisees, the Jewish elite. Because you don't do that. What do? You eat with those that are either on your level or, if you're lucky enough, even higher than you. That's what you do. Because who you eat with ultimately says something more about you than it does just about what you're doing, what you're consuming. And Jesus is consistently found at meals with outcasts. Consistently. What did Jesus do?
Forgave sins.
He did forgive sins. I'm glad we're hitting the big ones. That's good. That's an important one, I think. On some level, I mean, granted, we are going to talk about it more in detail with accomplishments, but whenever we're talking about his deeds, you can say on some level, forgiving sins is a pretty important part of what he came to do. Right? Yes? What are the major highlights of Jesus' ministry? I do think washing of the feet is important because it says something about who he is, and we're going to be talking about how this connection makes sense. I do think it's important that healing is something that we talk about. And you can't just disregard it. I don't care what your historical Jesus presuppositions guide you to. Ultimately, it's a part of his story, and it says something about who he is. Jesus, even where he's eating, who he's hanging out with, why he was debating, who he was teaching, says something about who he is. The deeds of Jesus are pretty clear. They ultimately reveal who he is, and it also reveals what we are supposed to be doing. So let me focus in on one particular aspect and use it as a catalyst to launch into a more comprehensive understanding of how biblical justice is impacted through the deeds of Jesus. Okay? Jesus rescues. And if I'm talking about the deeds of Jesus on some level, I would have to say healing, rescues, all of those fall under this kind of umbrella of he's a rescuer. As a matter of fact, Jesus is offering an exodus. Let me even use a different type of Old Testament metaphor. And this isn't something I'm just fabricating. This is something that is driven home throughout the Gospels, especially the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew has this interesting parallel between the story of Moses, between the Exodus story of Israel and the life of Jesus. So, at the very beginning of Matthew's Gospel, Jesus has a miraculous birth, Matthew chapter 1, verses 18 through 24. And in a sense, Moses has a miraculous birth in that he was supposed to be killed and yet he is preserved. He's even born somehow without the people that are on patrol looking for children that are being born. He's born without them knowing. I mean, I don't know if she wasn't screaming or what, but somehow he was born, no one detected him. Then you have, and he's thrown into the river and yet he's preserved. Jesus as a child is recognized as royalty in Matthew's Gospel. Matthew chapter 2. The Magi from the east come, and what do they say? Where is the one born? King of the Jews. They're looking for royalty. And as a child, Moses is recognized as royalty. Why? Because he's picked up from the Nile by Pharaoh's daughter and raised in Pharaoh's family. Jesus is led into preserve him, to save him from the mass killings. He's led into the heart of Egypt. Matthew chapter 2. Moses was too. To preserve him, they take him to the very heart of the land of Egypt, into Pharaoh's home. Then Jesus eventually offers an exodus in his ministry by passing through water, i.e. baptism. Matthew chapter 3, verses 13 through 17. Moses does too. He offers an exodus by passing through the waters of the Red Sea. And whenever Moses and the Israelites pass through the Red Sea, where do they immediately go into? The wilderness. And they begin to wander. And in Matthew chapter 4, verse 1, right after the baptism of Jesus, it says, and the Spirit, well, in Mark's gospel, it says, thrust him or compelled him or forced him into the wilderness. And as Jesus is being tempted by Satan in the wilderness, which the Israelites and Moses were as well, Jesus quotes three different passages, all of which point to Israel's wilderness wanderings. The next major event in the nation of Israel's life through this Exodus is when they receive the law. Same thing in the Gospel of Matthew. After his wilderness wanderings, where he proves successful, the next major event is Jesus sits down on a mountain and begins to teach his disciples, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Remember that passage? Goes on for three chapters. Right after the giving of the law, the next major event in the nation of Israel is the conquering of the land of Canaan. And in chapters 8 and 9 of Matthew, right after the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus begins to conquer the land, kind of, through healing 12 successive miracles in a row. All this just to reiterate something we've already talked about, and that is Jesus rescues. The Exodus motif is not on accident. The Exodus motif is to remind us of the key deeds of Jesus, and that is, he is a rescuer. He offers an exodus of salvation. Now here's the question. Is salvation that Jesus offers, the exodus, a reality for the soul only, or does it also include the physical reality as well? You've heard this debate, have you not? My word, this is like the number one hurdle to even justify on some level your interest in biblical justice. Well, you know, you shouldn't be focusing so much on the body, you should focus on the soul. I'm not disagreeing. I am disagreeing. Yeah, I totally am. That's what we are told. There's a part of that that is driven by the idol of salvation. There's a part of that that is driven by the only thing that matters is getting into heaven. That's it. There's a part of that that's actually driven by the story. Let's not act like that they're fabricating something completely either. Jesus does say in Matthew chapter 10, you should fear the one that can destroy the soul, not the one that can destroy the body. However, what did Jesus come and ultimately do? What did he rescue? Just the soul, or did he focus on the body as well? I want to look at this, first of all, linguistically, and then we're going to move to theologically. Linguistically, all we need to do is trace the word sozo. It's a pretty simple tactic. It's a pretty simple movement. But the word sozo in Greek means what? Save. If you know, a derivative of the word sozo is soter, which is the noun form, which means savior. So sozo is a saving action, an action that saves. So let's look in the context in which the word appears to then ask the question, what is Jesus focusing on, body or soul? Somebody read for me Matthew chapter 1, verse 21.
That's right, I'm not putting these on the screen this morning. That's for the next lecture if we get to it. That's why this is here. See, it's not the right text. See?
Matthew chapter 1, verse 21. Who's got it? Tasha will do that one. I need somebody to do Luke 19:10. Faith. I need someone to do Matthew 8:25. Dane. Mark 15:30. Chelsea. Matthew 9:22. Okay, Seth. And Luke 8:36. Josiah. Okay, everybody know what they're doing? Matthew 1:21. Go.
She will give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus, because he will save his people from their sins.
Okay, did you hear what she said? You will give birth to a son, and you will name him Jesus, because he will sozo his people from what? From their sins, body or soul. It seems in the context to be emphasizing the soul. I don't know if there's a way you can get around that. Now, you could try to ignore, you could try to say, well, you know, it's saving his people. But it specifically adds the caveat from their sins, which is a very soulish thing. I'm not suggesting that sins don't have physical ramifications. That's not what I'm suggesting. What I am suggesting, though, is that in that context, sozo seems to be more focused on the soul than the body. Okay? What about Luke 19:10? For the Son of Man came to seek and to save, sozo, the lost. Does the emphasis land on body or soul? If you had to, if somebody forced you in a corner and said, make a decision. What, it seems more soulish, does it not? To seek and save that which was lost. At least it seems on some level to be sin-oriented. And usually sin is categorized as something that affects the soul, primarily. Although I do think that there's ramifications in the physical, but that's a whole other issue. Now let's move to Matthew 8:25.
And they went and woke him, saying, save us, Lord, we are perishing.
This is in the context of Jesus has fallen asleep on the boat, and the waters are raging. And they come to Jesus, the disciples, come to him and say, save us, Jesus, because we're going to drown, we're going to perish. Save us, sozo us, body or soul. Seems pretty bodily, doesn't it? It's the same Greek word. We've not changed words. It's the same word. They come to him and say, save us bodily from drowning. Read Mark 15, verse 30.
Come down from the cross and save yourself.
Come down from the cross and sozo yourself, body or soul. It seems more bodily. If you really are the Son of God, then come down from the cross and sozo yourself. Which is very ironic, because the moment he comes down from the cross is the moment he's no longer the Son of God. It's like we do this to God all the time. If you do this, then I'll believe in you. If you do this, then I'll follow you. And he's saying, but if I do that, I'm no longer even worth following. If I do what you're saying, I'm no longer even who it is that I'm trying to reveal myself to be. So how about you stop putting expectations on me and you allow me to articulate my expectations? Come down from the cross and save yourself. No, sorry, I can't be the Christ without a cross. I can't be the Christ without a cross. However, for our purposes, that seems like that sozo is very bodily. What about Matthew chapter 9, verse 22?
Jesus turned and saw her. Take heart, daughter, your faith is healed
you. Go ahead. You're fine. Yes, the woman with the flow of blood for 12 years. She pushes her way through the funeral procession. Well, we didn't know it was totally a funeral procession, but it does eventually be one because of Jairus' daughter. She touches the hem of his robe. He says, I feel that someone's touched me. The disciples say, duh, everyone's crowding around you and pushing on you. Everyone's touching you. He said, no, there's something different. It's like power has left me. Something has happened. And Jesus finds this woman that had a flow of blood for 12 years, which does not incidentally parallel the fact that the girl that Jesus is about to resurrect is 12 years old. Why? Because he's talking about the spiritual state through the bodily forms of these two people of the nation of Israel. They are broken and dead, and through Jesus it will resurrect and become something that has life, known as the church. 12. But he looks at the woman and he says, no, daughter, first of all, daughter, inclusive language. This is family language. Your faith has sozoed you. In the passage it says healed. But that is the Greek word sozo, that we also translate save people from their sins, to seek and save the lost, body or soul, with this woman. Very bodily. Because the flow of blood stops. You see what's happening? Then Luke 8:36.
Those who had seen it told the people how the demon-possessed man had been cured.
Had been cured, sozo. Sozo, body or soul. I mean, that one's a little bit more of a mixed bag. However, what's emphasized in the context right before that is all the bodily things that they were seeing in this man. One of the things being, he's not even in his right mind. And now, after engaging Jesus, after encountering this one that has come into their region, now this man is sitting in his right mind. He's no longer cutting himself. He's no longer needing restrained. Bodily, he looks restored. He looks cured. What do you notice just from this short linguistic point? What do you notice? Is salvation body or soul? What? It's both. This whole debate of body versus soul bores me. It is so ridiculous. It is absolutely absurd. Because frankly, Jesus wasn't concerned with the debate. He just wasn't. We are, because there are political agendas behind the debate. You promoting a social gospel? I don't understand a gospel that isn't social. I just don't understand one. No, I'm not promoting the social gospel. But if you're asking if I'm promoting a gospel that is not social, then my answer is no. Because my king was very concerned with social issues, things that were destroying people, things that ultimately were destroying their bodies and their souls. Both, not just one. And he came and said, I will sozo all of it. Body and soul. As a matter of fact, a lot of times in this debate, if I'm feeling really cantankerous, I'll look at the person and say, okay, explain to me your position just using your soul, not your body. Go. And they're like, well, I don't understand it. Yeah, I don't understand either. Because you're separating me, you're dissecting me like a frog. As if part of me is a soul and part of me is a body. Okay, it's so clear, the distinction between them, that you can minister to only one and not the other, then speak from just one and don't speak from the other. No, you can't do that. It's not even possible. Why? Because the entire concept of me even asking that is ludicrous. Just like you're being ludicrous saying, I'm only going to focus on the body or I'm only going to focus on the soul. It's not possible. You can't split people like that. Why? That's not how we were made. Now we're moving into theology. That's not how we were created. We weren't created just a soul. We weren't created just a body. How were we created? What is it? What does Genesis 1 tell me? How were we created? We were created from the dust of the earth and in the image of God. Both and. Not just one. It's not like God just said, the only thing that really matters is soul, so I'm just going to create you as a soul. No, he created a body, called it good, and said, let me put my image on you, inside of you, imprinted on you. And he said, no, now that's good. And yet I'm going to go and say, oh, the body's bad, soul's good, I'm only going to focus on the body. That's my methodology? Explain that to me theologically. As a matter of fact, this concept of separating the body and the soul and even diminishing the body, denigrating the body, is more Platonic philosophy than it is Christian theology. For Plato says that to know oneself means to attend to one's soul at the exclusion of the body. Why? Because for Plato, the body is the corrupt reality where the soul is the true reality. This is evil. This is corrupt. We need to, as the Buddhists would even say, transcend all desires. Transcend this material world like the Gnostics would emphasize. Why? Because the Gnostics believed, which was a heresy condemned by the church, the Gnostics believed that the world was created by a lesser evil god. And this is what Colossians 2 even brings up. He says, you people say, the wisdom of the world is, this is the wisdom of the world. Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. That's the wisdom of Christians or of the world? Paul says in Colossians 2, it's the wisdom of the world. Why? Because the wisdom of the world says, if all this is evil, then stay away from it. But Paul looks at him and says, but what if God created this and called it good? Then it's not do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. It's make sure you understand what fire you're playing with and handle it right. Because physical reality is not evil, any more than spiritual reality is better. God created all of it, called it good, and He wants to redeem it all. He doesn't want, and that's one of the reasons why whenever you see the new heavens, the new earth in Revelation 21 and 22, he doesn't describe it in just some ethereal, spiritual, only soulish existence. It's very physical. Where do we find ourselves in Revelation chapter 21 and 22? Where do we find ourselves? You ever read it? You know what I'm talking about? Revelation 21 and 22. And then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the old heaven and the old earth that passed away, and there's no longer any sea. And what does he start to describe? Where do we find ourselves? We find ourselves back in the garden, where the tree of life has a river flowing from it that ultimately is producing crops, multiple crops from the same tree, different fruits, 12 times a year. We're back in the garden, which sounds very, very physical. Why? Because Romans 8 teaches us that Jesus died to also redeem this. Because this isn't evil. It's just broken. Kind of like you. Your body and your soul. And Jesus says, if you think that my target is just the soul, you're selling me short. It's just not big enough. My target is bigger than just a soul. It's everything. It's everything. And therefore, again, this little chart's becoming quite handy. If this is Jesus' goal, which would be body and soul, but we're only emphasizing soul, look at what we're missing. A big chunk of the gospel. He says, no, I have come to sozo. To sozo. Phones away. To sozo. Make sense? You following me? Also, I don't just have to point to creation, I can also point to incarnation. When Jesus came, was he just a soul or was he also a body? Help me. Please, tell me you know that orthodox answer. Yeah, he was both. And that's pretty important. Why? Because in the early church, they were having to fight people that were not denying the divinity of Jesus. They were having to fight the people that were denying the bodily existence of Jesus. As a matter of fact, in John's letters, the Johannine letters, 1st and 2nd John, he says, anyone that denies Jesus came in the flesh is the Antichrist. They're not of God. But notice the issue. We're like, Antichrist? Relax. He's not talking about some future figure that's coming way down yonder. He's talking about the people that are against Christ in the present that are saying what? He didn't come in a body. Why? How in the world could the creator of all the universe, the one that is holy and pure and perfect, become corrupt and evil in flesh, in physical reality? The Christian answer is because God came to redeem it all. He didn't just become a soul, and whenever people touched him, they thought they were seeing a body, but it was actually fake. If they put their hand, it would just go right through them. It's a soul. That's it. No, John says. He came very bodily. As a matter of fact, let's even just look at whenever Jesus resurrects. Does he resurrect just a soul or a body? What's your proof? Say it again. I'm hearing mumblings. I want to hear it louder. Yell it at me. Yeah, Acts 1, he's eating with the apostles. What else?
Thomas.
Yeah, explain to me that, the Thomas reference.
When he touches his hands, there's no body.
Yeah, Jesus says, you don't think I've resurrected? Hey, Thomas, come here. Put your hand in my side. Put your hands in my wounds. Does it feel real or fake? Did you pass through me? And how does Thomas respond in John 20, 28? He falls down and cries out, my Lord and my God. Thomas is overwhelmed. And John doesn't want us to forget that. Why? Because when Jesus resurrected, he didn't just resurrect as a soul. He resurrected as a body. A body and a soul. Redeemed. Restored. No longer under the bondage of decay. If Jesus' target is only the soul, why the resurrection the way it is? Why is it a corporeal resurrection, a bodily resurrection? Ultimately, if it's a bodily resurrection, then what Jesus or God is saying on some level is, I also value the body. I value the body and the soul. I'm not after just one. I'm after both. To which then I would say, why in the world? Why in the world then? Do we think we should be ministering to just one and not both? Where is your evidence for this? Where is your evidence to minister to just the body and ignore the soul? How can you get away with that after you look at Jesus's, after you look at Jesus's ministry? He doesn't ignore the soul. It's dead. It's part of the clear target. So I am not arguing for the body over the soul. That's not what I'm doing at all. Because if you do that, you're wrong. Because that's not what he did. No more than am I arguing the soul over the body. And people will say, well, but which one's more important? My answer is, the one that Jesus redeemed. Both. Both. He's not dichotomizing his creation the way in which you are. He's not compartmentalizing his creation the way you are. He is targeting all of it. Because he is not satisfied with Satan winning any piece of this battle. He wants it all. So linguistically, theologically, ultimately it both says, this splitting of the body and soul is ridiculous. And that's not what Jesus did. He never split the body and soul. He came to heal and restore it all. But I think we should even take this one step further. We mentioned this last class. It's our job as Christians in biblical justice is not just to restore body and soul. It is also to restore people sociologically. To heal them sociologically. Whenever people, let's just take modern day before we go back to the deeds of Jesus. Whenever somebody is asking for money on the side of the road, what do people normally do? I'm not saying you, I'm saying people. What do people normally do?
Avoid eye contact.
They don't look at them. If they do, if they look towards their direction, they'll kind of if Josiah was begging for money, I usually do one of these numbers. Where I cross him, I just don't actually stop and look at him. I know he's there. I'm just not gonna totally. Does that make sense? It's called sociologically murdering people. That's what it's called. You're treating them as if they're dead. As if they just don't exist. No eye contact. No interaction. Nothing. Sociologically, they're murdered. We do that today. In the ancient world, it was a little bit... It was even more blatant than just merely not making eye contact. If you were a leper, sociologically, you're destroyed. If you're a leper, you sociologically have no community. You have no home. The only home that you have is with other outcasts. And that's why Mark chapter 1, verses 45, I believe it's 45, I say that, 40 through 45, is a pretty interesting interaction between Jesus and the leper. And it's not interesting just because he heals him, although he does. A man with leprosy came to Jesus and begged him on his knees, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Jesus was annoyed. He was indignant. He's like, oh my gosh. But I don't know what he's annoyed at. It'd be weird if he was annoyed at just the leper. The indignancy of Jesus may be attached to a lot of different things, but the way in which he handles the leper makes me think it may not be geared towards him. Anyway, Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. Physical contact. Jesus says, I am willing, he said, be clean. Immediately the leprosy left him and he was cleansed, bodily or soulish. Bodily, yes.
I just have a question. Mine has a little footnote at indignant. It says that many manuscripts say that he was filled with compassion.
Yeah, there is a textual variant, but frankly, if it's indignant, if you have two different manuscript traditions, one says indignant, one says compassion, more than likely you're going to say the original is probably the more difficult. I could explain how people would want to change the word indignant to compassion. I'd have a hard time explaining how people could change the word compassion into indignant. Does that make sense? So more than likely the earliest manuscripts, or even maybe not the earliest manuscripts, but I'm using textual variant, textual critical tools, I would say indignant is probably the more original. Because I can't explain the shift from compassion to indignant.
Did they try to change it?
Because they don't want Jesus. Yeah. It's weird having Jesus indignant in the moment. And that's why I asked the question, but indignant at what? At the leper? No, we know that can't be right. That's why they change it to compassion. So what is he indignant at?
And I think ultimately it's the plight of the leper. It is everything that surrounds them. It's one of those things where it's like, why are you coming to me and not going to the Jewish? How come the Jewish people have not dealt with this yet? Both physically, spiritually, and socially. He reached out his hand and touched the man, physical. I am willing, he said, be clean. Immediately the leprosy left him and he was cleansed. Jesus, now listen to this. This is the part that to me sticks out. This is interesting. Jesus sent him away at once with a strong warning. See that you don't tell this to anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest and offer the sacrifices that Moses commanded for your cleansing as a testimony to them. Why does Jesus have him go offer sacrifices and show himself to the priest? Why does he do that? Because maybe we could say that Jesus is still kosher? Possibly. Although eventually he destroys the whole sacrificial system.
Because that means the leper is clean.
Because that means the leper is clean.
Because he can offer sacrifices in the temple.
Because all of a sudden now, the leper, when he goes and shows himself to the priest, offers the sacrifices to Moses, now he's also socially healed. He's allowed to be back in the community. You see, if you only understand leprosy as a physical ailment, as something that happens to the body, then you don't understand the plight of the leper. Whenever they receive this physical ailment that ultimately they probably will or could die from, that in and of itself is emotionally destroying. But then think of the fact that they now have to leave their family. They now have to leave their wife and their kids, maybe never to see them again. They now have to leave their synagogue of worship. They now have to leave their job. They now have to leave all of their community. And they have to go live by themselves with a group of outcasts of people that the only thing they have in common with is the fact that they're all dying. And Jesus looks at him and he says, I will heal your body, but I want to heal you socially. So even though I will destroy the sacrificial system, go to the priest, offer the sacrifices, and embrace your community once again. If biblical justice only heals someone's body or only targets their soul and doesn't also target what else they have lost, and that is social interaction, community, being a part of society, on some level having dignity, then we're not doing biblical justice. Because that's just not all that Jesus did. He heals the body. He heals the soul. He heals them socially. And next class, we will give one more category of what else he healed. And then we'll move on to words. Until then, though, have a good weekend. Love you guys. See you on Tuesday.